Hello, everybody. Today is Wednesday, October 23rd. I am Bill Murphy. I'm here with the Front Pages. I will be reading from the New York Times and the Hartford Courant. Take a look at the pictures on the front page. The picture on the front page of the Times, the main picture, is a picture of, I believe it's a nun. It's at a large public hospital in Lebanon. And I don't know what she's doing. She's standing and looks like she's adjusting some curtains. The caption says, an area near Lebanon's largest public hospital was targeted ahead of Secretary of State Anthony J. Blinken's tour on Tuesday. And we will have that story. I believe it'll be my third story from the Times. Going over to the Current, there is a picture of inside a in the town hall of West Hartford where people are voting. It's the second day of early voting, and you can see people in there casting their vote. Big sign on the door says voting here today. We will have that story. That'll be my first story from the Hartford Current. So we will start with the New York Times. This is from Washington. When the history of the 2024 election is written, one of the iconic images illustrating it will be surely the mugshot taken of Donald J. Trump after one of his four indictments, staring into the camera with his signature glare. It is an image not of shame, but of defiance. The image of a man who would be a convicted felon before Election Day and yet possibly President of the United States again afterward. Sometimes lost amid all the shouting of a high-octane campaign heading into its final couple of weeks is that simple, if mind-bending, fact. America, for the first time in history, may send a criminal to the Oval Office and entrust him with the nuclear codes. What would once have been automatically disqualifying barely seems to slow Mr. Trump down in his comeback march for a second term that he says will be devoted to retribution. In all the different ways that Mr. Trump has upended the traditional rules of American politics, that may be one of the most striking. He has survived more scandals than any major party presidential candidate, much less president, in the life of the Republic. Not only survived, but thrived. He has turned them on their head, making allegations against them into an argument for him by casting himself as a serial victim rather than a serial violator. His persecution defense, the notion that he gets in so much trouble only because everyone is out to get him, resonates at his rallies where he says, they're not coming after me, they're coming after you, and I'm just standing in the way. But that, of course, belies a record of scandal stretching across his 78 years, starting long before politics. Whether in his personal life or his public life, he has been accused of so many acts of wrongdoing, investigated by so many prosecutors and agencies, sued by so many plaintiffs and claimants that it requires a scorecard just to remember them all. His business went bankrupt. And multiple others failed. He was taken to court for stiffing his vendors, stiffing his bankers, and even stiffing his own family. He avoided the draft during the Vietnam War and avoided paying any income taxes for years. He was forced to shell out tens of millions of dollars to students who accused him of scamming them, found liable for wide-scale business fraud, and had his real estate firm convicted in criminal court of tax crimes. He has boasted of grabbing women by their private parts, been reported to have cheated on all three of his wives, and been accused of sexual misconduct by more than two dozen women, including one whose account was validated by a jury that found him liable for sexual abuse after a civil trial. He's the only president in American history impeached twice for high crimes and misdemeanors, the only president ever indicted on criminal charges, and the only president to be convicted of a felony, 34 in fact. He used the authority of his office to punish his adversaries and tried to hold on to power on the basis of a brazen lie. Mr. Trump beat some of the investigations and lawsuits against him, and some proved unfounded, but the sheer volume is remarkable. Any one of those scandals by itself would typically have been enough to derail another politician. Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s first bid for the presidency collapsed when he lifted some words from another politician's speech. George W. Bush came close to losing after the last-minute revelation of a long-ago drunken driving arrest. Hillary Clinton fell short, at least in part, because of an FBI investigation into emails that led to no charges. Not Mr. Trump. He has moved from one furor to the next without any of them sinking into the body politic enough to end his career. The unrelenting pace of scandals may, in its own way, help him by keeping any single one of them from dominating the national conversation and eroding his standing with his base of supporters. He even turned that mugshot into a marketing tool, selling T-shirts, posters, bumper stickers, coffee mugs, and even beverage coolers with the image and the slogan, "Never Surrender." And victory next month may yet help him escape the biggest threat of all, potentially prison. And we're going to go to our next story in the New York Times. Let's see right here. Okay. From London. This is from London. It was a spectacular falling out. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan had risen to power largely thanks to the support of a preacher and fellow Islamist, Fethullah Gulen, who died this week. Mr. Gulen's million-strong following of educated and motivated Turks helped fill the ranks of government as well as the media. The police and law courts helping Mr. Erdogan run the country and cement his power. In the early years of Mr. Erdogan's leadership as prime minister, Gulen followers were the most prominent spokesman for the government in Turkey and abroad. But by a decade later, Mr. Erdogan had come to resent Mr. Gulen's reach and differences over policy emerged. The first break came in 2013 when Gulen's prosecutors started corruption proceedings against members of Mr. Erdogan's government and even against his members of his family. Mr. Erdogan accused Mr. Gulen of directing a judicial coup and moved to close down some of Mr. Gulen's holdings in the media, as well as his lucrative education centers that prepared students for university entrance exams. The rivalry turned deadly when members of a group found to be aligned with Mr. Gulen, some visited him in the United States, attempted a military coup in July 2016. Mr. Erdogan faced it down, bringing his supporters out on the streets and securing the allegiance of military and intelligence leaders who moved to arrest the coup leaders. He then cracked down with a vengeance, not only against those immediately involved in the coup attempt, but also on the wider circles of the movement. Tens of thousands of followers of Mr. Gulen were arrested. Their businesses and properties were seized, and 150,000 government employees were purged from their jobs. The Turkish government issued a warrant for Mr. Gulen's arrest and requested his extradition from the United States, where he had lived in self-imposed exile for many years in Pennsylvania. Mr. Erdogan was never successful in bringing Mr. Gulen back to Turkey. The United States government cited a lack of evidence for not moving on the extradition, but he did succeed in crushing the Gulenist movement, branding it as a terrorist organization and imprisoning many prominent leaders with draconian sentences of multiple life terms without parole. By the time of his death, Mr. Gulen had lost much of his support among families whose relatives were in prison, and thousands who had been forced to flee Turkey and rebuild their lives as refugees. The attempted coup had a profound effect on Mr. Dugan. We're going to stop there with that article. And I have a couple more from the Times. And I'm going to read a story about Antony Blinken. This is from Jerusalem. Amid rocket attacks by the militant group Hezbollah into Israel and Israeli bombardment around Beirut, Secretary of State Antony J. Blinken began a tour of the Middle East on Tuesday, making renewed calls for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and a diplomatic solution to the escalating conflict in Lebanon. Meeting with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem, Mr. Blinken pressed Israel to capitalize on the killing last week of Hamas's leader, Yahya Sinwar, and to end the war with Hamas in Gaza, a State Department spokesman, Matthew Miller, said in a statement. On his 11th trip to the Middle East since the conflict began a little more than a year ago, Mr. Blinken met with Mr. Netanyahu for 2.5 hours. His visit was bracketed by the sounds of air raid sirens in multiple locations across Israel during the morning and afternoon as the military tracked what it called Hezbollah projectiles coming from Lebanon. The morning attack on an Israeli military base near Tel Aviv sent residents fleeing into shelters but caused no casualties or significant damage, officials said. In Beirut, the Lebanese capital, rescue workers pulled bodies from the rubble of buildings hit overnight by the Israeli military, killing at least 18 people, including 4 children, according to Lebanon's health ministry. The buildings were near Rafik Hariri University Hospital, the largest public health center in Lebanon, which was also damaged. On Tuesday afternoon, a separate Israeli airstrike leveled a building in the Daya area south of Beirut minutes after a Hezbollah spokesman briefed reporters nearby. The Israeli military described the target as Hezbollah intelligence headquarters with 25 Hezbollah members present. The spokesman, Mohammed Afi, told reporters that Hezbollah had taken responsibility for an aerial attack that targeted Mr. Netanyahu's house in Caesarea in coastal Israel on Saturday, which his office has called an assassination attempt. Israeli censors on Tuesday allowed the release of images showing drone damage to what the Israeli news media described as a bedroom window above a swimming pool. As Mr. Blinken met with Israel's leaders, the Israeli military confirmed it had killed Hashem Nafedin, the presumed successor to Hezbollah's assassinated leader, Hassan Nasrallah. Speculation about Mr. Safedin's fate had swirled since Israeli warplanes unleashed strikes targeting a meeting of senior Hezbollah leadership around midnight on October 3rd. The Israeli army said it also killed Hussein Ali Hazema, the head of Hezbollah's intelligence headquarters, at the same strike. As news broke about Mr. Safedin's death, a new wave of Israeli airstrikes sounded across the Lebanon on Tuesday, the capital, actually the Lebanese capital. President Biden and his administration have repeatedly tried to calm the widening regional conflict. In addition to fighting Hamas in Gaza and Hezbollah in Lebanon, both groups are backed by Iran. Israel is said to be weighing retaliation against Iran for an October 1st missile barrage that Tehran said had been payback for the killing of Mr. Nasrallah.